You're listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, where you get valuable information you just can't find anywhere else. To thrive in today's trying times, you need the Financial Survival Network, now more than ever. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and get your free newsletter and gift. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.
Welcome. You are listening to watching the Financial Survival Network. I'm Carrie Lutz. It is February 16th, 2022. One of my favorite guests is going to be on with us in a moment to discuss what's really happening with inflation. If you've been to the supermarket, if you wrote a rent check recently, if you did anything other than make your mortgage payment, you see the inflation. It's happening all around you. Everything is more money. Just yesterday, the wholesale price index up 9.7%. There's a debate. Is inflation really running double what the government admits to? It's running higher. I think we can all agree on that. Hey, go check out Wolf Richter's site, wolfstreet.com. It is must reading. Wolf, I don't know how you produce all these articles. For me, I slave over one. I can't, for me, it becomes like a Michelangelo. I'm like working on the Sistine Chapel here, but somehow you managed to do it. I guess that's the difference between being a professional writer and being a lawyer like me. It's just difficult, but it's great to have you back. So tell me three things in your life that have gotten cheaper over the past year.
Oh, thanks, Carrie, for having me back. Well, let me think here long and hard. Okay, I'm going to give up. I don't think there's anything that's gotten cheaper. And that might have been something. Yeah, I learned to cut my own hair. So I'm not going to get exposed to the inflation at the hairstylist. And I'm not switching back. So that's
your calling. You missed your calling because your hair looks pretty damn good. That's funny. So you found, but effectively, if I were an economist, which thank God I'm not, I would say, Wolf, you have just discovered the substitution effect. Instead of paying a hairdresser to go hack away at your hair, you figured out how to do it yourself. Next thing, you'll be opening up a salon.
Yeah, and I'm going to do my own root canals too pretty soon, I think.
Okay, just don't do your own vasectomy. I know somebody who did that once and it wasn't good. But inflation has a pervasive effect. It turns savers into spenders, right? Why save money when your savings are eroding at a rapid rate? You'd rather buy real estate, almost anything. Buy wrecked cars. Have you seen the price of not even used cars, but wrecked cars? They're setting records.
Yeah, I mean, what's happening in the whole spectrum of the automotive business is just completely nuts. I've never seen anything like that, and I used to work in it for a long time. And it's just unprecedented, especially the used vehicles. You know, there's no shortage of used vehicles. There's plenty of supply in the wholesale channels. There's plenty of supply on dealer lots. New vehicles, we've got this problem with the shortages, but that's not the case anymore in used vehicles. There's more than an average supply now in terms of days. And yet, these prices continue to spike all last year. Now, we're seeing them sort of level off now, and I don't know if that will hold. But as far as they have spiked last year, they're 40%, something like that. And, so they're leveling off, they're not, at this point, they're not getting cheaper. So they may get cheaper, but they'll get cheaper by just a little bit. And then it will unleash more demand, and that will end that process. But, there's no reason for them to be 40% higher than they were a year ago. And that's exactly what happened. It's an inflationary mindset. People have gotten it into their heads that they need to buy these cars at those prices. And dealers saw that. And so they went out at the auction and, they held their nose and closed their eyes and bid up the vehicles because they knew what they were doing, And so this, and it is filters down to wrecked cars, it filters down to everything. But it's just an incredible distortion of off the normal auto market. And I cannot, I write about it constantly, you know, but I just cannot wrap my brains around how this could even have happened, because we didn't run out of used cars. There's no shortage of used cars. You know, we've had plenty.
Hey, it's really funny because traditional investment theory tells you don't buy luxury goods, don't buy used cars, because don't buy cars, new cars especially, because it's a wasting asset. And in fact, the OEMs, the big manufacturers, have been hiding billions of dollars in losses in their car leases, because the residual values, what's left of the value of a car when it goes off lease, was always greatly overstated. Now, through this magic of higher used car prices, you have two phenomena that I've never seen anything like. Number one is you have the phenomena of the person who, you have a car lease, it's at the end of the term, and you actually have equity in your car lease. It's a highly leveraged transaction. You're always upside down historically, but now you have equity. Same thing when you finance a car, you have this phenomena of being upside down, meaning that you owed more on the car the day you drove it out than it was worth. That's all been reversed. And then you've got basically a bailout of the auto industry of their captive finance arms, because now all these cars coming off lease and all their collateral for their auto loans is worth more than the balance of the loan or the lease. I've never seen anything like it. So it stood conventional economics on its head, effectively.
Yeah, that's, I mean, we've seen that in many aspects where a lot of classic models were just upended by these distortions. And the leasing thing is one thing, you know. I mean, it's true. You always have the option of buying out the lease. And most people looked at it and said, no, forget it. And the car went back to the leasing company and they took it to the auction and sold it. And then it became a used car from that point, or the dealer bought it from the customer. Now, I mean, you can buy, you're having to pay as much for a two-year-old used car than the equivalent new car will cost, except you can't get the new car, so you can't buy it, you know. So it's got that kind of thing, or, you know, if you want a specific new car and you can't get it, you're buying used, you're paying the same price or more for the used car than you would have had to pay for the new. And this doesn't make any sense. I mean, this is completely nonsensical, but that's exactly what we've got right now. And it's just a whole system gone haywire.
It really has. So going back to rents, so your article yesterday about the fact that there's going to be a spike, there is a spike in rents. I mean, in Florida here where I live, I've seen them go up 20-30%. In New York, they're back to where they were prior to the pandemic, or getting close to it, going higher in these metropolitan areas that were particularly hard hit by the pandemic. I mean, these rent increases are ongoing. It's not like everybody just raised the rent at once. Your leases expire throughout the year and then are renewed, presumably, or people move out. This has a profound effect on the CPI and the real estate market, doesn't it?
Yeah. So the asking rents, so these are the market rents that that landlords advertise when they have a unit up for vacant. Yeah. So what we see is the asking rents have just spiked. And in Miami, it's like 30%. And in some other cities, it's 20%, 25%. And in San Francisco, you know, they're still down over 20% from the peak in July 2019. But that's an exception, really, having been such an expensive rental market and hit a ceiling, you know. And that started, that downward trend in San Francisco rent started in 2019. So that was pre-pandemic, it accelerated. But yeah, in many other cities, in Fresno, California, a little town in the Central Valley, you know, the rents are up 28%. And there's no shortage of land or anything. So when we say rents are up, these are asking rents. This is what landlords are asking for the apartments that they have on the market available. And so when you sign a lease finally at that rent, then it will gradually become part of the actual CPI. CPI tracks what people are actually paying for their rents. And so that includes rent controlled areas. It includes tenants who have not seen a rent increase because the landlord is wanting to keep them and they're good tenants. Yeah, and so you're trying to create long-term stability and maybe they only raise the rent 5% when in fact the market rents go up 10%, that kind of thing. So you have a lot of that. And the CPI data looks at how much people are actually paying in rent over time. And so this huge spike in asking rents that we're now seeing will take about 24 months to completely filter into the CPI figures. And that's kind of what we're looking at here. So we've got this huge spike in asking rent. An enormous spike in asking, a historic spike. We just haven't had this. And it will impact our inflation figures for the next 2 years, regardless of what happens in the market. Even if rents don't go up anymore, CPI will go up based on this. And I don't think rents are going to stop going up at this point. So they're going to continue to go up, but maybe not at this incredible rate. But when people say CPI is going to go back down, inflation is going to go back down. Well, no, it's not necessarily, because we've got this housing section in CPI. Housing is 32% of CPI. It's all based on two factors that are tracking rents. So, rents impact CPI by that way, 32%. And this, so it's about a third. And so if the rent inflation that's picked up in CPI goes up by 3 percentage points, it means CPI will go up by 1 percentage point, or we're 7.5% now. So it'll go to 8.5. And if the rent factors go up by 6 percentage points to get more closely to the spike in asking rents, that we're seeing now, you're looking at 2 percentage points increase in CPI. And that's already baked into the numbers. We've already got that. So we can just put a calculator to it and figure out what that will do. And that's what it will do. And, that's where we are. And maybe it'll get worse, maybe it'll get better in terms of the market rents. But in terms of CPI, that's for the next 12 to 24 months, that's what we'll see. We'll see 1 to 2 percentage point increases just based on the rents that have already occurred.
And there's a thing, let's not forget, because CPI does not measure the cost of owning a home. What it does is it creates this thing called OER, owner's equivalent rent of primary residence. And, because to the CPI, housing's not a capital, is not a consumable good, a consumer good, it's a capital good. So I got to believe that the OER is going to go up the equivalent or at least as much, maybe more, as the actual rents paid by tenants around the country.
Don't just survive, thrive. The Financial Survival Network.
Osino Resources is a Ross Beatty-backed gold exploration company in mining-friendly Namibia. Osino's district-scale land package is situated near two producing gold mines, one of which Osino's management team previously developed and sold to B2 Gold. Osino's founders and management are experienced mining professionals who have already successfully developed and sold two companies in the past 7 years. Osino has a tight share structure, and with its current treasury, it can self-fund the advancement of its gold discovery into at least 2022. This is an exploration company with drills turning that you'll definitely want to pay attention to. Osino trades in New York under the ticker OSIIF and in Toronto under the ticker OSI. To learn more, go to osinoresources.com. That's osinoresources.com.
This is the Financial Survival Network, the information you need to thrive now more than ever.
Yeah, so it's interesting. The OER is a survey of homeowners, what they would estimate their house would rent for. And that can be higher than actual rents. So these are homeowners and they can say, oh, my house is a nice house. It's going to rent a little bit more than my neighbor's house. And so when we look at the historic data, we see a little bit of difference there. And so it could be higher. And that doesn't move with the market. That's a perception. So this is a homeowner's perception of what their house would rent for. And if there's a lot of news in the market about rent spiking, those homeowners that get these surveys are going to respond to that. And over time, you know, this takes a long time to go into to make itself known. And so I think there could be more of a spike. But of course, this is included in the 32% of weight. So there's two rent factors, you know, and that's one of them. But people say CPI will go down next year or the end of this year. You know, I'm just saying, no, we've got these rents, you know, we already know what they are. It's already baked into the numbers. We're going to see those numbers come out, you know, later this year or throughout this year and throughout next year.
Okay. And let's not forget the cost of building a new home, which is somewhat related to your perception of what you could charge for rent or pay for rent on your own owned home. Everything is going higher. Lumber skyrocketed, come back down to earth. It's still over double what it was 2 years ago. And copper and, you know, every component of building a home, not to mention labor, has all gone up. And then there's shortages of all this stuff, which is making new home construction even more expensive because builders, if they hadn't planned ahead, can't bring their new homes onto market fast enough. Therefore, their interest costs and the cost of holding, their cost of capital, is going to go up. And that's going to affect housing prices, not to mention the fact in places like California and other restricted markets, you just can't build new homes the way you can here in Florida or Texas or Tennessee or Georgia, where they just said, hey, if you build it, they'll come.
Yeah, I mean, the finishing part of new construction is a super big issue right now. And we had window shortages. Yeah. So, I mean, it's just ridiculous. Yeah. Yeah. There is a glazing shortage. So the manufacturers, and then they ran into labor problems. The manufacturers make the windows. And there's a building being built on the street from me. And it got hung up for months with two windows in it. And I couldn't get the rest of the windows. You know? And you can't finish, you can't work on the rest of the building if you can't put the windows in it. You can't finish the outside. You can't do anything on the inside. You know, you've got to seal the building first. And so everything was on hold. Nobody was working on it. And then they got some of the windows in. And then, yeah, before then, there was steel I-beams that were short. This thing has been now that they started this before the pandemic. You know, it's been over 2 years. And it's not a single family home. It's an apartment building. But it's just a nightmare trying to finish something. I can't imagine the cost overruns that these people face over a 2 year period. All the materials go up. The labor goes up. There's these delays, the shortages. You've got to find different windows, alternative products, you know, that kind of stuff. Appliances, try to find appliances nowadays. You know, it's prices. And if you do find them, you know, prices are way higher. So this is the construction industry is facing a huge mess.
Huge mess. And hey, we didn't even talk about the biggest thing of all, labor shortages. Now, I'm not quite sure how we wound up in this mess. I mean, obviously people were getting paid not to work and effectively their labor becomes, they go for the highest price, which is don't work. Or even if they're not getting quite as much, hey, it's a lot more fun to stay home and play video games and watch Netflix for some people, not for me. Even if I didn't get paid, I'd still be working to doing something. But the labor shortages, this is like another thing. Like, how did this happen? And what's the cure? Higher wages, obviously, is part of the cure. But you got this great resignation. Our generation is just throwing up their hands and saying, I had enough. And I guess there's not enough millennials that want to do the dirty jobs.
Well, you got millennials and younger people that make a running ton of money in cryptos and stocks. And, you know, you go from $20,000, put that into something, and suddenly you're sitting on $1 million, you know, and you think, okay, next year I'm going to do the same thing. Why should I work? You know, and I'm going to do this for the rest of my life, you know, You know, so, and that is a true issue. And that's now been documented as, we used to do the same thing during the dot-com bubble. A lot of us, you know, quit. I did too. I quit and I traveled around the world for 3 years, you know, on those stock market gains. And there was a lot of fun and I loved doing it. And, yeah, so this is a real factor. Now, if the markets and cryptos turn south hard enough and stay down long enough, a lot of these people, just like during the dot-com bubble when it burst, they go back to work. And some of those people are the smartest people around. You know, they're really good to have in the workforce. And that's really a good thing when they go back to doing productive activities. And instead of sitting around the house with their multi-screen trading rigs and just playing the markets, yeah. And I think we'll see some of that. And we don't know how many millions of people did this, but the Great Resignation played into that. I mean, there's some people of all ages really in that group. So that is one factor, I think. So if markets turn south hard enough, we'll see the labor shortage abate somewhat. Higher wages will solve some of that problem and is already helping out a little bit. And yeah, then we have all these other issues with families not being able to find childcare centers. And there's just a whole, they're getting really expensive. They can't afford it. Yeah. So there's this whole other element to just practicality. And so we have a household with two income earners and one of them stays home with the kids. And so you might get $2,000 less in income, but you save $1,500 worth of expenses. And you know, after taxes, it kind of washes out. And a lot of people make that calculus. And so there's all kinds of elements in this. I don't know that we'll ever get back to the labor market we used to have. This may be finished, you know, but I think over time, the labor shortage will abate somewhat.
Yeah, you would think. Best cure for shortages are higher prices, and the best cure for surpluses, lower prices. Yeah. And we just forget as Americans that labor is a market. And then you get something like the pandemic comes around, and all of a sudden, economics 101 becomes front and center of all of your concerns. And the disincentive to work, that's what we're talking about. The safety net has been a disincentive. The unearned income tax credit that they just started handing out like candy on Halloween, that definitely had an impact. And then, like you said, the wealth effect, the stock market goes up. These kids, they make $1 million on GameStop or some other worthless meme stock, or then they go and reinvest all their profits into cryptos, and then before you know it, they pay cash for a new house in a nice neighborhood, and they travel the world for the rest of their lives. I saw a statistic that I didn't believe. Maybe you know more about it, that 4% of the country's labor force had stopped working and are living off their crypto winnings. Can that be?
You know, I mean, crypto went from very little to $2 trillion. So, and it's not like they can actually sell the cryptos. You know, if everybody did that, they will crash. What they're having to do is leverage them. And you can. And you feel wealthy. And there is that. I mean, that is, and you know, if they actually sell the cryptos at the peak of the market and buy a house with it, I mean, good for them. I mean, that's better to do that than to watch all those wealth gains evaporate again. And like they did during the dot-com bust, you know, a lot of us.
Yeah.
Much of the wealth that was.
you got to remind me of this, Wolf, really.
We've been through this now. We kind of know how it works. And this is not going to be any different now, but it has similar effect, except it's so far bigger. You know, there's so many more people involved in this. And the numbers are so much huger. I mean, it's just a gigantic amount of money that they're translated into some sort of wealth. And so it could be 4%. I mean, I don't, I, might well be, you know.
That's an incredible number. Hey, one more question for you, and then we'll let you get on with your day. Stock market, is the so-called correction that took place taking place? Is that the sign of things to come, or lower liquidity? Is that going to lead to a bear market?
Yeah, so I think what we have to keep in mind is what drove the stock market up from March 2020 until the end of last year was the Fed's monetary policies largely, and to some extent, the fiscal policy. So people got this extra money, the PPP loans and all this other stuff, you know, and they bought cryptos and they bought stocks and they bought some other stuff with. And so now that, that's ending. And the fiscal stimulus has ended. The monetary stimulus is ending as we speak in the near future. So in early March, the QE will be done. Maybe mid-year, later this year, the Fed will actually start reducing its balance sheet. Interest rates will go up. So this will have the opposite effect of the interest rate reduction in QE that we saw in the prior 20 months. And on asset prices, you know, and I don't think the real economy will be hurt by this, but asset prices will interest rates go up, bond prices go down by definition. So that you'll have that. Mortgage rates go up, house prices go down. And, if you have a significant move in mortgage rates, the housing market is going to feel that. And stocks are not very well equipped at these high levels to deal with the Fed's action to crack down on inflation. And then the Fed is way behind. It's going to move too slowly and it's going to pussyfoot around this. Yeah, but it's still going to raise rates and it's still going to reduce its balance sheet. And so I think we will look at a fairly long downward trend across the board of these overinflated asset prices that we've seen as it gets undone. You know, whatever the Fed did for the past 22 months, some of it's going to get undone. And so we'll see that wash out, I think.
All right. Well, interesting. Kind of tend to agree with you, but I think there's hidden liquidity in this market. I think they printed up way more money than they needed during the whole pandemic, and they're trickling it out to keep things going, but they don't have to admit to printing it now. It's kind of akin to what a smart CEO will do when they take over a company that's had reverses. They write off everything but the kitchen sink. So then when the company turns around, they've got these amazing growth rates. They've got these amazing profits. But really, it's because they just wrote everything off. So we'll see what happens. Anyway, I highly recommend Wolf's site, wolfstreet.com. Great articles, a lot of them. Like I say, really well written and very informative to help you get a better handle on what's going on in the world. If you got a question for Wolf, you can always shoot me an email, kl@carrylutz.com. And make sure you go to the site, financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Sign up for your free newsletter. Wolf, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you, Carrie.
Thanks for listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, your solution to today's trying times. For the latest, go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.